welcome to another edition of The Drop. I'm your guest host, Beau Riston, Public Affairs Officer with the West Virginia National Guard. Today, we would like to welcome our very own Adjutant General, Major General Bill Crane, to the studio. General Crane has served as TAG since January of 2021 and has guided the organizations through the end phases of COVID, many overseas deployments, multiple domestic response operations and mission support efforts, and provides the overall supervision and the day-to-day operations and management of the readiness, fiscal, personnel, equipment, and real property resources of the West Virginia National Guard. General Crane was commissioned in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in May of 1989 through the Reserve Officers Training Corps program at West Virginia University. Prior to this assignment, he served as director of the Joint Staff and previously as the United States Property and Fiscal Officer for the West Virginia National Guard. He has also held roles as the Chief of Staff for the West Virginia Army National Guard and Commander of the 111th Engineer Brigade. General Crane completed the United States Army War College through a fellowship at Old Dominion University, where the emphasis was on modeling, analysis, and simulation. He completed a deployment to Baghdad, Iraq, where he was the J3 Director of Operations of the Joint Interagency Task Force for High-Value Individuals. Prior to his full-time employment with the West Virginia Army National Guard, he was a chemist, where he developed chemical processes that allowed him to be awarded 3 United States patents. General Crane, welcome to The Drop.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, sir, today we wanted to talk to you about China and the concept of near peer in great power competition. Since 9/11, the U.S. has spent the past 2 decades highly engaged in the global war on terrorism. Counterterrorism and anti-insurgency operations were the primary focus of military planners, and our operations primarily revolved around our fights in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the greater Middle East. With the ends of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the slow de-escalation of operations supporting the war on terror, U.S. military planning doctrine and focus has shifted. While we still have a persistent threat emanating from sub-state and non-state actors such as Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Hezbollah, Hamas, Boko Haram, and Shining Path in Peru as examples, the primary focus of the U.S. military has shifted from the war on terror to what is termed near-peer competition. The 2017 National Security Strategy declared the dawn of great power competition between the United States and assertive powers such as China and Russia. The strategy was quick to cite areas in which the United States had fallen behind and China had developed asymmetrical advantages. The Pentagon has affirmed as much, writing in 2020 China Military Power Report that, quote, China has already achieved parity with or even exceeded the United States in several military modernization areas, end quote. The 2022 National Defense Strategy declared China the most consequential strategic competitor for the coming decades and has highlighted strategic competition with China as a serious challenge for the U.S. military for the foreseeable future. Can you explain to our listeners your views on what exactly near peer means, why the shift in planning and posture is important, and why China is of particular concern?
Yeah, so I think I'll start with the middle question first. Mm-hmm. I believe that, you know, the United States is always willing to have competition, but they want fair competition. And I think most people would agree that over the years, China has not necessarily played on a fair or even playing field. And so I think, you know, in the recent history, we've had the United States see some of the things that they're doing and have started to realize they need to start pushing back on that a little bit. And the other part I would say is, you know, you have peace comes through strength. And so being able to compete against a near peer and them know that you can compete well against them will always help us to maintain the peace and prosperity that the world has seen since World War II. And that the United States has been a big part of ensuring that we have. And so, again, I don't think that anybody would say that we don't want to have a competitive environment, but we all want to make sure that we're playing on a level playing field and that the state actors aren't, dumping so much money into their industries that they're anti-competitive. And so, again, that to me is something that we've got to stay focused on. We want to make sure that we have a peaceful world. That is, in my mind, that's what the United States wants, because there is much economic prosperity when the world is at peace. When you're at war, there's a lot of people suffering, as you can see from what's going on in Russia, what's been going on with in the Middle East with the Hamas and Israel. And so, again, I don't know that anybody's looking for war, so we just have to be able to show strength as the United States and make sure we are focused on those actors that are not acting in a way that's conducive to the good world order.
So this provides a perfect segue into our second question, which revolves around budgeting. China spends a reported $230 billion per year on defense, although that number is suspected to be grossly underestimated. These funds are being spent in rapidly developing multiple aspects of military capabilities, including nuclear, next-generation fighters and bombers, drone technology, advanced long-range artillery and infantry weaponry, naval ship construction, space-based platforms, and cyber weapons of all types. Can you speak to how this rapid growth and expansion poses a direct threat to U.S. influence in the Indo-Pacific theater and how Chinese actions are impacting our allies in the region?
Yeah, I would say first and foremost, you're exactly right. That number is grossly under what they actually spend. They're pretty good about hiding it into other industries, and almost everything over there is a state-owned entity, an SOE. And so by the fact that they own everything, they're able to have their fingers into everything and have them shift their development to whatever it is that they see is necessary. And the other thing that we all have heard the United States accuse them of is intellectual property theft. And so if you don't have to spend the money to develop the technology, you're able to get it from somebody else, you don't need to spend quite as much money because you can just, you know, tweak around the edges of what somebody else has already built. And so, you know, there's a lot of comparisons between some of our jets, like the F-35 and their joint aircraft. So, again, I would say, they are using a lot of their the Belt and Road Initiative as well as a means of some soft power, go in and make promises of building infrastructure to help countries that are just now developing. And, what the United States has really been able to do lately is to help those countries truly read what those contracts are saying, what they're actually getting themselves into. And they're finding out that in many cases those are not great contracts in the future for their country, because the United States is helping them to understand what it is they're getting ready to sign. And so you've seen some cases where countries are saying, hey, we're not going to do that. We're not going to use, you know, some of your equipment. We're going to go a different direction.
So with that, again, a perfect segue into the next question. And you talked about the Belt and Road Initiative. Overt operations, China's involved in overt operations within the South China Sea, including harassments and near-miss encounters with U.S. and allied aircraft operating in international airspace. Just this past week, we saw large-scale exercises and intimidations threatening Taiwan. It's clear to see that China wishes to flex its military muscle for all the world to see, but you brought up something that's very important in regards to their diplomatic and their economic expansion and efforts to influence world politics through those initiatives, not just via military might. So could you speak a little bit more about the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road, which is part of China's $1 trillion Belt and Road Initiative? And there's currently about 150 countries that are engaged in this project. And as you stated, the details are in the fine print. So for perfect example, you had the Sri Lanka's deepwater port, the Hambantota port, which China spent over $2 billion constructing. After Sri Lanka was unable to meet their financial obligations in regards to paying for that port, China initiated a 99-year lease of the project and of the land surrounding the port, which allows them full access and control of the deepwater port, and that's a strategic location within the center of the Indian Ocean, which impacts global trade, things of that nature. So can you describe some of the additional efforts China is engaged in the Indo-Pacific region, as well as in Africa, the Middle East, and South America, that pose risks to U.S. dominance and U.S. hegemony?
Yeah, as you're, I'm sure, aware, you know, one of our state partners, and we'll talk about our partners a little later, but one of our state partners is Peru. And Peru is also looking at a deep water port. And that is in our hemisphere. It's in the southern hemisphere, but it's on this side of the world. And so it would give them a much closer proximity to the United States. And so it becomes an issue that we've got to think through. And so we, in my mind, that's putting pressure on us. And so we have to figure out how we maintain the pressure on the other side and figure out, is there a way to kind of, you know, encircle them a little bit so that they feel the same kind of pressure that they're trying to place on the United States. Another one that I am aware of, you know, we're also a state partner with Gabon. We haven't signed the agreement yet, but we're headed there real quick. Again, China wants to have that Atlantic port, and so that would be a perfect location for them, and it's in Africa. They've built out a lot of structure throughout Africa with the same kind of issues that you talk about with Sri Lanka. If they don't make their payments, it becomes basically Chinese property. And so it's real challenging for these countries to make those payments and keep up with that stuff. And China is more than happy to take advantage of those things. And I think the other thing, Bo, that the United States is really starting to get better at doing is putting together packages that show those countries, hey, yeah, they're going to put this amount of money in for this Belt and Road Initiative, but understand this is how much the United States is putting in. And they're collecting that from USAID, you know, from the Department of State, all of the different entities and the businesses. You know, the amount of businesses that come from the United States that go into some of these countries, we're finally pulling all that data together to provide to them to show them, hey, look, that may seem like a lot, but in reality, if you look at the long haul of the United States being here, that's a pittance in comparison.
So all of the actions that China is taking across the spectrum of military, diplomatic, financial, and information arenas is a part of what experts inside and outside of China refer to as unrestricted warfare. The term was originally coined in a book published in 1999 by two People's Liberation Army colonels, and centers around the concepts of alternative methods other than direct military conflict to win the coming century. The list of unrestricted fronts that they have identified as critical include not just conventional warfare, but also psychological warfare, smuggling warfare, media warfare, drug warfare, network, technological, fabrication, resources, economic aid, cultural, and international law warfare as well. This brings us to an interesting topic in the fact that China is an authoritative government, and as you've stated, most everything is government-controlled, state-controlled, state-controlled entities. And in many ways, that greases the skids in order to rapidly develop new technologies, to rapidly implement new policies and procedures. So can you speak a little bit about how authoritative governments can utilize all these fronts in coordinated efforts more easily than a democratic republic government can? And how can the U.S. military, in our role, address or influence policymakers here in the U.S. to see the larger unrestricted threat that China poses that will require not just us, but a full multi-agency and whole-of-government mindset?
Yeah, so as you know, a lot of the United States government and many of the democratic governments are pretty stovepiped. And they are all doing their own thing under the direction of the president, but they're all kind of doing their own thing. Where in an authoritarian environment, you know, everything is done exactly the way the state says it should be done. And, you know, so when you start talking about unrestricted warfare, you know, I think one of the things I would ask everybody that's listening to this, you know, is find the 36 stratagems that they're old stratagems from China. And they talk about a lot of, you know, they'd rather have their enemy fight their enemy as they sit on the hill and watch. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a strategy. They want to hide and have sleight of hand. They don't ever want to show their power. And so for many, many years, the Chinese made us all believe, hey, we're just a third world country, and, you know, we need your help and all of that to grow and do things. And boy, did we ever help them. And so now we've helped them to the point that they've become the near peer competitor like I'm talking about. And, you know, the other thing I would say is if you look at the opioids that are coming into our country, a lot of the precursors are coming out of China. And if you walk back in history, you will remember there were the opium wars. And so there were a lot of Chinese citizens that ended up on an opiate. And I promise you, they learned from that. That's in their history. It's in their DNA. And so they know how to use that to their advantage. And, you know, social media platforms, again, lots of bots that help them do that stuff. They pay people just to do, you know, social media on X or on TikTok or whatever it is. You know, the TikTok that they have in China is limited. Kids can only watch it for so long. It is also more science-based, whereas here it's not that. So it makes me question, okay, why would there be a difference? If it's TikTok, then why isn't it TikTok the same around the world? And so to me, there's certainly a reason that I believe our government is looking at banning it, unless they sell it to a company in the United States. So, but I will tell you, if people would read the 36 stratagems, it would give them some real insight into their mindset and how they think about things. And they're not going to fight until they absolutely believe they either have to fight or they can easily win the fight.
So you commented that the investment levels from China portrayed themselves as a third world country, and we have invested as the United States, as capitalist societies, not just in the United States, but throughout Europe and things, have invested heavily in helping China build. And build their infrastructure, build their capabilities, so that we could receive the benefits of that that labor market and of the goods and products flowing out of China. And so their economy has boomed and grown exponentially over the past few decades. The COVID obviously was a worldwide incident that impacted all economies. But in China specifically, we're seeing now some signs of trouble that COVID may have helped to bring to the forefront and identify, or at least shed some light on. Many China experts are becoming increasingly worried about the Chinese economy and its potential impacts on both Chinese and global financial stability. While China has had a robust economy and the engine of global growth for decades, it currently faces a host of problems, including slow internal growth, high youth unemployment, local government debt, a property market in complete disarray, and demographic declines. The U.S. Rating Agency Fitch said in August that China's slowdown was, quote, casting a shadow over global growth prospects, end quote, and downgraded its forecast for the entire world in 2024. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo recently called the country uninvestable for some American firms. Many experts see China in dire danger of a partial to severe economic collapse. Now, while on the surface this may seem like a good thing, less money in the Chinese economy means less money for their military and unrestricted warfare initiatives, some analysts are concerned an economically weakened China could be a more aggressive and dangerous China. This is particularly pointed in relationship with Taiwan. Would a destabilized China be more or less likely to invade Taiwan? So you tie this in perfectly. While China is playing for the long term and sees that long goal of a century of dominance, could the current economic impacts within China, do you think that might pose more or less of a threat for them to maybe step up their activities prior to their original plans if the Chinese economy does nosedive?
Yeah, I think absolutely we don't want to collapse. I think the other part I would say is, you know, that the Chinese people are just like the people in the United States. They're very proud of their country. And so when they see that they could be a number one in the world, they're proud of that, and they should be. I don't think anybody's looking to have them have an economic collapse, because that's not good, again, for any – it's not good for them. It's not good for the rest of the world. They are a huge market, potential market, I'll say it that way. You know, but again, the leaders of that country have to play by some rules that around intellectual property, around, you know, fairness within the country and those kind of things, because up till now they haven't. Europe is trying to sell batteries to put in their cars, their electric cars, which they are moving way forward in that environment. But they won't allow that to happen, because, you know, even though they're better quality batteries, they last longer and all of that, they won't let them come in, because they're trying to keep those jobs right there in China. And so we've got to continue to work with them. You know, they tout themselves on, you know, talking about the cars, they tout themselves as, oh, we're all about clean energy. But if you look at the real numbers, you know, they're one of the largest producers of carbon that goes into the atmosphere in the world. Okay, so, you know, the rhetoric and the talk doesn't match the science and everything behind it. I mean, to the point that, you know, they would go in and, you know, play around with the monitors that are monitoring smog and stuff in their cities, so that they could say that they were meeting standards. Then they weren't, not even close. I mean, even their people realize, you know, why are my eyes burning? You know, so again, it's if you're going to try to be a part of the world, and you're going to be a world player, then you've got to be honest about what you're doing and what's been going on, you know. And they wouldn't let us. They would not let the body come in and figure out how COVID started. I mean, so there's just a lot of things that, as you talk about authoritarian government, they can close off really quickly, and it may or may not be to the benefit of their people. And in this case, I don't think it is. And so, you know, hopefully one day their people will understand what that means, and that if they want to be a part of the world community, they've got to be a part of the world community and follow some kind of rules that the international order has put together.
So, backtracking just for a moment here, you had mentioned Peru earlier, and I'd like for you to speak a little bit more about our state partnership program and the potential influence within our hemisphere from China, and how our partnership with Peru and those of other SPP nations, and SPP states and the nations that they represent in South America and Latin America, how our relationships, such as SPP, can help deter and weaken Chinese influence in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, so again, it's really about trying to get these countries to see that we are a partner of choice, that we're going to be there for the long haul, and we're not trying to take advantage of them. We want to help them to excel along with us. And a prime example of what we talked about earlier, you know, when 300 Chinese fishing ships show up off the coast of Peru and they fish out the entire, you know, sea out there, that may be beneficial to China, but what does that do to Peru and their fishing needs? You know, that they're a fishing culture. They're a coastal culture. And again, not following any kind of world standards, that's very harmful to a lot of countries. And I think you'd find that the same thing is going on along the coast of Africa and other locations, because, again, they have a very large population that they have to feed, and I understand that. But Peru has a population they got to take care of. Gabon has a population they have to take care of, and so it's a whole world that's got to work together to make sure we're not overdoing anything, whether that's putting carbon in the air, or that's out, you know, overfishing, overhunting, cutting down too many trees, you know, and that's one of the things I'll tell you. Gabon, as our partner, they are like us, about 80% of their country is forested, and they're protecting those forests. That is a key thing for them and their government, is to protect those forests. And so when you have a partner like that wants to help the good of the world, you know, we ought to figure out ways to help them as much as we can and make sure they see us as that partner of choice, because they're gonna only do great things to help the rest. I mean, keeping those trees alive is helping us take out a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. And you know, it'd be real easy for them to look at the short term and cut those trees down and make some quick cash, but ultimately that's going to harm them and the world. And so that's the kind of partnerships we've got to keep working on. You know, Peru does the same thing. And then our other partner in Qatar, you know, they're a big manufacturer of natural gas, and they too have been looking at their economy, and they understand that is they're trying to figure out how to transition to a different economy in their country, because they know that you know, in 50 years they may not have that as an income source. So they're looking to see how they can have different industries that they're invested in, and also you know, they have started their own agriculture. They have their own dairy cows and stuff, you know, so they've become much more self-sufficient over the years as well. So, you know, I think we have three great partners in those three countries. And, I mean, we haven't gotten into the Gabon as much as we will, but between Peru and Qatar, I mean, both of those countries, we've just taken off with them. And, you know, and there's over 100 of those partnerships with National Guard states across the whole world. And they've only been really, really helpful in my mind to make sure that they understand we're here for them and we want to help them in a positive way and not take advantage.
So let's shift focus for a second here and kind of get away from China specifically, and let's talk about the near peer and power competition in a broader scope. So when you talk to troops around the state, you state emphatically that in the new era and arena of new near-peer competition, that we must get out of the mindset, the mentality that has driven our strategic, our operational, and our tactical operations over the past two decades. You often say, and I quote here, the days of the FOB are over, end quote. Can you expand on what you mean by that and how we as a force need to rethink the next evolution of warfare?
Well, it's just like always, if you can see a target, you can take out a target, okay? And that's only gotten more dynamic with loitering munitions, with UAVs. The ability to see the battle space has only expanded. And now, you know, a smaller country can have that capability for a few thousand bucks. You know, that's an incredible amount of utility for a few thousand dollars. And so if we're setting on a FOB, we're a target. That's a target. If an airplane or seven or eight are setting on an airfield somewhere, that's a huge target. And so we've got to make sure our folks understand they've got to be able to move in an instant, because that is how they're going to survive. And so again, that's why I talk about the days of the FOB are gone. And with the development of some of the munitions now, you know, hundreds of miles from the front lines is still not safe. No, almost nowhere in the world is safe. You know, if you think about trying to get ships near China or near Russia, they know that a long time before they get there, and they have capabilities that can reach out and touch them long before they get close to the coastline. And so, again, we have to understand the environment that we're in now, you know, and we have to make sure that the adversary understands what we can do as well. Because, again, it's peace comes through power, and peace comes through them understanding our strength. And, you know, I think our government does a pretty good job of showing our capabilities. And, you know, we've been continuing to help the Ukrainian forces against the Russian forces. And I think that's also shown some of the capabilities that we have that are in our arsenal. And, you know, that's not everything we own in our arsenal. So, you know, it does help to show what we can do. But I also think at the end of the day, we don't want to get into that. We don't want to get into that kind of a fight. We want to make sure that we can figure it out, you know, some other way, because that's not the best path forward for anybody in this world.
So within the mentality of getting off of that forward operating base, that FOB, one of the large aspects of that is, and we've seen this in Ukraine quite effectively, is irregular warfare. The West Virginia National Guard just recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the Irregular Warfare Center and is heavily engaged in the Ridge Runner and Ridge Healer programs. Can you speak to those programs just a little bit and why they're so important and how they fit perfectly and seamlessly into this idea of getting off of the FOB and this the future war fight that we are potentially looking at?
Yeah, so it goes back to what I've been talking about with our partners, number one. You know, unlike us, imagine how threatened the Republic of Georgia feels. Imagine how threatened Lithuania, Latvia,
Poland.
Imagine how those partners feel with Russia already invading Ukraine. I mean, in my mind, they obviously are going to think, hey, we could be next. And so they feel the pressure way more than what we and in particular the American people feel it, because their people see it, and it's right next door. You know, for us, it's an abstract. It's not a concrete concept in the Americans' minds yet. But we're just as, you know, susceptible to that attack as what they are. And so what the irregular warfare exercises help us to do. Number one, it helps to train them up to be prepared. That if they do come through, that they can resist. They can do things to make it really challenging for their adversaries. And so that's one of the things that we're training them up on how to do. And then in the Indo-PACOM area, Indo-Pacific, as you know, the distances that are involved in that theater of operation are so expansive that golden hour of trying to keep somebody alive, it gets real challenging. So you want to be able to figure out different ways, some austere medicine ways, you know, even teaching them how to set up a hospital in a basement of a building somewhere so that they can survive a direct, you know, a bomb or something like that, and keeping people alive or performing a surgery right there on the spot with whatever they have available. And so that's kind of the things we've been trying to teach our partners. And, you know, in this irregular warfare, you know, the adversaries are using a lot of other actors, is what I would call them. You know, Russia uses other actors that they can say, well, that wasn't us.
Little green men.
Yeah, that was somebody else. It wasn't us. And so, you know, they do... critical infrastructure probing is going on all the time in the United States. You've seen what happened with Colonial Pipeline. You've seen what happened at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport when the GPS system suddenly went down. You know, those aren't accidents. Those are probing, in my opinion, those are probing actions so that they can see how to take down the critical infrastructure in the United States. Imagine, you know, in 2012, we had the derecho. We had over, you know, 800,000 of our citizens that did not have power for a week. That's 1 week. Imagine if the entire grid goes down and it's down for months. Imagine that's New York City. You know, imagine that's Chicago or D.C. or Dallas-Fort Worth. You know, that's going to tie up a lot of resources just trying to keep the population from collapsing. So our focus would be so internal. And so if you think about how best to tie the United States up, it's to take down the critical infrastructure. And now we can't focus on the away fight. Okay, and so that's things that we've got to always be thinking about.
Absolutely. So to wrap that into a nice bow, being able to understand and grasp the larger picture, such as the growing threat posed by China, while still focusing on the details of our day-to-day missions, is paramount to being effective and to our lethality and being lethal. From your perspective, what can we do as soldiers, airmen, and civilians even, to better understand and prepare ourselves for the ever-evolving emerging threats that we face as a fighting force? Can you recommend books, videos, other media that would help our force better understand the concepts of unrestricted warfare and near-peer competition?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, the number one book I would recommend, this is one I found off of Amazon, but, you know, read the 36 Stratagems and understand the way that our adversary, our near-peer competitors are thinking. This one in particular is China. There's a great book, The 100-Year War, that also talks about China has, you know, they want, after the end of the Opium Wars, they said, hey, in 100 years, we want to be back to the top. Okay, and so just reading constantly and understanding what our near-peer adversaries are looking at and trying to do. There's some books on geography. I think you all put my list out here recently. You know, if you think about why Russia fears Ukraine being an independent country, you know, look at Ukraine. It's a plane, and it's a plane that goes right to their doorstep. And so you can understand their concern if you believe that the world is out to get you, which, you know, may or may not be true. But again, that's the mentality, and you have to understand the way they're thinking. Because if you can understand that, then you might be able to mitigate it, or you may be able to, you know, assuage their fears, or whatever it might be. But we all have to understand our adversaries, because you have to understand how they're thinking about things. You know, and I will tell you, in my opinion, it's going to be real hard for authoritarian governments to ever match the United States because of the NCO Corps, the faith we put into our NCO Corps, the training we put into them, and allowing them to make decisions autonomously and not have to come clear from the top. And so, you know, that's a different mindset for Russian, Chinese forces than what it is for the United States. And so I think it will be real, you know, if it comes down to it, I have great confidence that we have some incredible NCOs and officers and enlisted, but that NCO Corps is the real key to what makes the United States what it is.
Well, you mentioned your reading list, and so I'll put in a shameless plug for our West Virginia National Guard social media pages, as well as our main website at wv.mg.mil, which has your full reading list out, and that's your recommendations for this year for all the soldiers and airmen and civilians to take a look at those books. Reading is both professional development and personal development, and it's critical in moving the organization forward and keeping us as a professional organization.
And as many resources as are available to either read them, listen to them, you know, the resources are there. None of us have really an excuse not to read and be more professional. So, you know, I just encourage people to always try to keep up with that kind of stuff.
All right, sir. Well, it's time to wrap up here. With the NATO 75th anniversary on us. Lots of training happening right now with West Virginia National Guard troops in Europe, participating in large-scale NATO exercises such as Defender 24 and things. We've got folks in Southcom in South America right now with Resolute Sentinel and things of that nature. What else is there? What else? Was there anything else that you would like to speak about or speak directly to the troops?
Yeah, so number one, I would say, you know, it's about partnerships, and that, I've talked about that. It's actually, you know, one of my imperatives is that we've got to build partnerships, and that's whether that's with other countries, whether that's with other agencies, you know, understanding and adding to the team only makes the team better because those teammates help fill in gaps that we may have. And so, you know, always be thinking about how we can build the partnerships and how we can work together with our partners, because that's what makes us better. You know, as we respond to disasters, we have to work with emergency management folks. And so we don't want that to be the first time we do that. We want to work with them and talk to them early on. You know, number two is train really hard. You know, we have to be ready for this next fight. You know, I don't want to have to go tell a family that they've lost somebody. That's a really hard thing to do. And I don't want myself or anybody to have to do that. And so through hard training, you will prepare the people for the next conflict that may come. Hope it never comes. But if we're prepared, then that makes it, at least we've done everything we can to be, you know, to bring our people back home. You know, I want to tell everybody how much I appreciate them. You know, this is, it truly is, a one guard family. It is my family, and I know a lot of people feel that way about it. I have watched us help one another. I have watched us reach out when people are having some problems and do everything we can to support them and take care of them. And that's what this is about. It's about taking care of our members, their families, our retirees, our employers. All of that ties us together as a big family of just doing what we can to help each other along. And, you know, we live in an environment now that is just fraught with all kinds of opportunities to do bad stuff. And so reinforcing the good messages of, hey, don't drink and drive, don't do drugs, don't do this, you know, those are important. And we have to continue to trust the NCOs to keep that message alive and pushing our folks to do the right thing. And as leaders, just trying to give them the resources to do great training and do great things. And so at the end of the day, I'm so grateful to lead such an incredible organization. Both the Army and the Air and the Joint have just come together and worked so well together. And that's the kind of teamwork and team effort that I had always hoped to see. And I see it every day now. So again, I can't thank the team enough for what they do to support the governor, the state, and our country as we train and fight to get the resources and train hard to make sure that folks are ready.
Gotcha. General Crane, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this deep dive into your size. Every soldier, airman, and civilian in the West Virginia National Guard is proud to serve our communities, our state, and our nation. Understanding these complex issues will impact us for decades to come is vitally important to the success of our organization and is the continued safety and prosperity of our nation. A special thank you to our audience. Please like and share this content and share it with your fellow airmen and soldiers and with your families as well. Keep tuned for future issues of The Drop. Thank you.
Thank you. And do everything you can to go out and find another recruit to join our great organization. Because at the end of the day, strength is what drives us to get the resources, and it shows that we are ready to do whatever we need to do.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for The Drop. For more information about the 130th Airlift Wing, visit us on the web at www.130aw.ang.af.mil. Additionally, you can find us on all major social media platforms. Lastly, you can see us in the skies delivering freedom with courage. This is Second Lieutenant DeJuan Haley reminding you to stay ready to go.